from Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today on the program, as Eric Cantor steps down as majority leader after his shock primary defeat, we ask how will it impact the quest for immigration reform?
They want to go back to the White House on the 2016 or 2020. They need to pass immigration reform.
Also, an update from the London Conference on Gender Violence. The White House confronts a foreign policy disaster in Iraq, and it's time for the kickoff. But at the World Cup in Brazil, the soccer balls come from Pakistan.
Many of the factories there are still receiving large orders as soccer fever rises alongside the biggest sporting event in the world.
That's all ahead on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. President Barack Obama says he's considering all options, including military action, when it comes to battling Islamist militants in Iraq. He was speaking at the White House after the cities of Mosul and Tikrit were captured by Sunni insurgents from a group known as ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. Mr. Obama said his national security team are working round the clock on the issue. Malcolm Brown reports from Washington.
Barack Obama says his team is working on ways to provide the most effective help to the Iraqi government in light of events over the past few days, but he avoided specifics.
I don't rule out anything because we do have a stake in making sure that these jihadists are not getting a permanent foothold in either Iraq or Syria, for that matter.
The U.S. leader indicated that the immediate need is to provide military assistance, but he also called for political progress in Iraq to promote cooperation between moderate Shiites and Sunnis.
And in Iraq itself, security has been stepped up in the capital, Baghdad, after a video emerged showing the insurgents threatening to advance on the city. A vote to grant the Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki emergency powers was delayed after members of parliament failed to turn up. Ukraine's interior minister has said three tanks have crossed the border from Russia into the east of the country through rebel-controlled checkpoints, and fighting is now underway. But the Kremlin has called the statement another fake piece of information. It comes as Ukraine's new president, Petro Poroshenko, held a phone conversation with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin about plans to settle the crisis peacefully. Meanwhile, the threat of Russia turning off the gas taps to Ukraine and Europe remains a source of concern for the European Union. Talks between Russia, Ukraine, and the EU in Brussels have still not resulted in any agreement. Kiev says it won't accept Russia's latest gas price offer. Here's Jack Parak from Brussels.
A third of Europe's natural gas supply comes from Russia, and 15% through pipes which cross Ukraine, which is why the European Union has been trying to broker a deal between Kiev and Moscow to ensure Russia doesn't stop the gas flowing. Russia wants Ukraine to pay up its gas debts and has said Kiev must pay $2 billion by the 16th of June and $1.8 billion by the 26th, otherwise they'll cut supply. But Ukraine says the current price offer of $385 per cubic square meter is too much and they will not come to an agreement unless it's lowered. Ukraine and the EU also want to ensure that price remains the same in case of further political disagreements. Negotiations between the three sides are continuing through to Monday, when we'll know whether energy ministers have managed to come to a deal and resolve the price battle.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The Obama administration has resumed firing missiles from drone aircraft at suspected terrorist targets in Pakistan. Within the past 2 days, the U.S. has attacked a compound in North Waziristan at least twice. Priscilla Huff has more.
On the record, the Pakistani government strongly condemns the drone missile attacks as a violation of Pakistan's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Off the record, Pakistani government officials have admitted complicity in working with the Americans, suggesting that they are joint operations and that missile strikes from drone aircraft are necessary for the war against the Taliban. The most recent attacks were against a suspected Haqqani Network compound in North Waziristan, leaving at least 10 dead. It's thought that Islamabad agrees now is the time to give Washington a freer hand and to allow more drone missile strikes to proceed.
The World Cup soccer tournament is getting underway in Brazil. Teams from 32 countries are competing for a place in the final in Rio de Janeiro on the 13th of July. Ahead of the opening ceremony, Sao Paulo police used tear gas on anti-World Cup protesters. But Brazilian football legend Pelé hopes the tournament will be seen positively.
I think this is the moment to really show the country, to, you know, to make, of course, promotion, to grow as a country. I think we cannot miss this moment.
But meanwhile, British comedian John Oliver said on Late Night with Seth Meyers that he's not optimistic about England's chances of success.
So this year, we're probably not going to win, which we've now gone full circle and said, but hold on, the fact we don't think we're going to win means they're under less pressure, meaning they'll perform better, which means we're going to win. We're going to win.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
While I intend to serve out my term as a member of Congress in the 7th District of Virginia, effective July 31st, I will be stepping down as Majority Leader.
Eric Cantor bowing to the inevitable on Capitol Hill last night and announcing that he will leave his position as Majority Leader in the U.S. House of Representatives. One of the highest profile Republicans in Congress, his electorate evaporated in a primary in Virginia on Tuesday. His scalp claimed by the Tea Party and their favored choice for Congress, economics professor Dave Bratt. Bratt's victory was built largely on arguing that Eric Cantor had gone soft on immigration reform, and Mr. Cantor's defeat is being seen as a damaging blow to hopes that some kind of comprehensive immigration reform will be concluded during President Obama's second term. Gustavo Torres is the executive director of Casa de Virginia, one of the largest pro-reform NGOs in the country. He told FSN's Andrea Arenas that Tuesday's election makes the need for an immigration deal all the more vital.
Get the work done. That is exactly the message that they sent to Leader Cantor, but also to the entire Democratic and Republican Party. Remember, 72% of the district voters in District 7, that is majority Republican, strongly support immigration reform. They were very disappointed because Majority Leader Cantor did nothing about immigration. So they didn't trust him anymore. So that is the reason why they sent that a strong message. Get the war done. And I think that the message is not only for the Majority Leader Cantor, but also for the Speaker Boehner and for the Republican Party. So I hope that they got the message.
Some analysts suggest that Eric Cantor's defeat will further delay a vote in the House of Representatives on immigration reform. Do you agree?
It's very early to assume that it's going to be dead or it's going to be delayed, etc. I think that what we need to do is to wait for additional 24, 48 hours to see the result of the meetings, because right now I understand that it's a lot of meetings in the Republican leadership to make additional decisions. So we'll see what happens. But the important thing is that we want to know if the Republican leadership are going to take the Tea Party way or the American way. So the Tea Party way is more complicated, is more difficult, is very impossible to get things done, or the American way, working together, both parties, to resolve this crisis that we face in our communities and in our families. The Latino and immigrant community in Virginia, we are going to keep fighting. We are going to keep demonstrating that we want immigration reform either through the Congress or through President Obama's executive order. I think that is a great opportunity for our president. If the Republicans make a decision not to move, now the president is have his hands free to say, I am going to exercise my executive authority to stop deportation. So we see a great opportunity for the president as well if the Republicans don't move.
Do you think that the immigrant community has more of a challenge now that Bratt is in office and not Eric Cantor? Will it be more difficult for the immigrant community to fight for an immigration reform?
I think that that has been very, very difficult. The window has been closing and closing, and I think that Eric Cantor was not a friend of the Latino and immigrant community. I mean, the last information that we saw, the last propaganda that we saw in District 7 was that he is attacking the Senate bill passed last year for both parties. You know, more than 60 senators passed the bill, and he was opposing to that. So he was not a very good friend of the Latino and immigrant community. However, he had a lot of power. And right now the issue is what exactly the Republican leadership are going to do. We hope, and again, we hope that they are going to use the judgment and say we need to pass this because we don't want to be a minority party forever. They want to go back to the White House on the 2016 or 2020. They need to pass immigration reform.
So is there a plan of action that the immigrant community is going to follow?
Absolutely. On the 28th, we're planning a big protest all around the nation. If the Republicans don't pass immigration reform, that is our goal. We have been planning that for a long time. You are going to hear from not only from Casa de Virginia and Casa de Maryland for the entire movement fighting for immigration reform. And after that, our deadline is 28. After that, if we don't see anything, we move to the White House and we are going to start actions in front of the White House until the president exercises his executive power and provide a relief to our families.
Gustavo Torres, the executive director of Casa de Virginia, talking there to FSN's Andrea Arenas. This is FSN Reports. Now to Iraq, which has all the makings of a foreign policy crisis for the Obama administration. Kurds in the north of the country moved militarily today to secure their territory in and around the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. There was some urgency about that, given the startling gains Islamist militants have made over the past 72 hours, taking the cities of Mosul and Tikrit and vowing to keep pushing forward all the way to Baghdad. The Obama administration says it's ready to offer fresh help to the government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. The Obama administration says it's ready to offer fresh help to the government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. But even White House loyalists concede the president and his team have been caught flat-footed by the militants' advance. At the White House today, the president said he's ruling nothing out.
What we've seen over the last couple of days indicates the degree to which Iraq's going to need more help. It's going to need more help from us, and it's going to need more help from the international community. So my team is working around the clock to identify how we can provide the most effective assistance to them. I don't rule out anything because we do have a stake in making sure that these jihadists are not getting a permanent foothold in either Iraq or Syria, for that matter.
Robert Fox is the defense correspondent for the Evening Standard newspaper in London, and he told Lisa Aziz of Britain's LBC Radio that with the militants advancing, Iraq's future as a unitary state is at stake.
Well, they're perched at Samarra, which has a very famous Shiite shrine, the Golden Dome there, which was blown up by Sunni militants earlier on during this ongoing on-off civil war, we really have to call it that, in Iraq. Baghdad is a big conurbation. Quite what they're going to do is really hard to work out. I think they'll have a go at something by the weekend, though.
Tell us more about the militant group in particular, called ISIL, what they stand for, and are they indeed Sunni militants going up against the Shiite leadership?
Oh, it's a Sunni Shia split. Just get that. I mean, that is basic to it. It's called ISIL or ISIS because it's either this is the anglicization of it. It is the Islamic State in Syria and in Iraq and Syria, hence ISIS, or in Syria and the Levant, makes no difference. It grew out of al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia or in Iraq, which really got going 2 or 3 years after the Americans arrived. There's a mysterious leader called al-Baghdadi, of which there are only two alleged photographs. So he may have been taken by the Americans briefly about 4 or 5 years ago and held in detention. But he really does seem to know about command and control on the ground in running guerrilla warfare. I mean, what happened in Mosul on Tuesday is really spectacular, because they came in, bashed the center, knew who they had to get at with the regime's army, and they just laid down arms. They gave up within an hour and started legging it out of the city. And a few hours later, half a million citizens were on the move, fleeing the city. And then they pushed on to Tikrit, Saddam's hometown, a home base, where it is largely Sunni, where they appear to have linked up with, would you believe it, still rump forces from the old Saddam army. And there's even a rumor that the last surviving old general on the run, Izzet al-Duri, has joined up with this new force. But it's been going for some time. They took Fallujah 6 months ago, and that is now an ISIS town. But just think of it. It is what it says on the tin. It's got some kind of entity that goes right up through Syria to Aleppo, up the Euphrates, putting pressure on Turkey, and it goes right up the Tigris into the Kurdish land, putting pressure on Turkey and Iran that way.
Robert Fox, the defence correspondent of the Evening Standard, talking there to Lisa Aziz of Britain's LBC. Government representatives from Nigeria have joined American and British officials in London for a summit on how to tackle the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. The meeting came on the fringes of the ongoing international summit to end gender violence in conflict zones. Boko Haram remains in the spotlight after the group kidnapped more than 200 girls in Nigeria back in April. FSN's London correspondent Dan Whitehead is at the conference.
It's the final public day of the summit in London, and more than 1,000 ministers are here from around the world. They're gathering in the delegates' lounge just to my right. It's a chance for them to meet their counterparts and discuss policies informally. However, the real action has been taking place behind closed doors at a sidelined summit on tackling Boko Haram. Officials from Benin, Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria joined those from the UN and the UK to discuss the threat of the Islamist militants. The Undersecretary for Human Rights, Sarah Sewell, represented the US. Topics on the table included improving regional coordination in Nigeria and looking at further options to combat terrorism. The British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, chaired the meeting and said real progress had been made.
Nigeria and Chad, Benin, Niger and Cameroon have today confirmed that they will put into operation a regional intelligence fusion unit, bringing together their intelligence efforts to find and pull together all available information and to tighten the net around Boko Haram. And the UK, along with the United States and France, will provide the necessary technical expertise for that.
Well, downstairs in the main summit area, those charities with people working on the ground in Nigeria were keen to stress that the country's government has to be held responsible for finding the girls kidnapped by the group back in April. Angela Quatra is from ActionAid.
Nigeria, you know, has the means to look for the girls and to find them. But we think that it is really helpful if the international community can get behind Nigeria, can offer help in a coordinated way. And also ensure that Nigeria realises that this problem is not going to go away.
Well, on Friday, the US Secretary of State John Kerry will be flying in and joining organisers at the close of this major summit. All are hoping that a week of meetings here will turn into real action for the victims of sexual violence. Dan Whitehead, London.
Next, the moment the world has been waiting for. The World Cup kicks off in Brazil today, heralding the start of a month-long soccer tournament that will galvanise audiences and pitch 32 national teams against one another. In large parts of the world, towns, cities and villages will come to a standstill as the teams fight it out for world soccer's greatest prize. Pakistan is not sending a team to the World Cup, but it will have a key player on the field in Brazil. That's because Pakistan manufactures many of the soccer balls that are used in the tournament. The footballs, called Brazuca, come from the northeast Pakistani region of Sialkot. FSN's Mary McCarthy spoke to Pakistani journalist Midhut Alizaidi and started by asking her about how Sialkot first got into the ball-making business.
It is said that during the colonial reign in the Indian subcontinent, some British soldiers punctured a soccer ball they were playing with, and they took the ball to a local cobbler for repairs. The cobbler did not just mend the ball, but he also studied how it was made and started making them on his own. Later, he persuaded the soldiers to buy from him instead of getting them supplied from abroad. Now the city of Sialkot is a hub of sporting goods industry and supplies 70% of the world's hand-sewn soccer balls.
And it turns out that many of the workers actually making the footballs are in fact women.
Yes, it is quite unusual in Pakistan for women to be working in factories, but they have traditionally been a part of the soccer ball making industry in Sialkot. Their ability to neatly sew the panels together was initially the reason for women being employed by the soccer ball manufacturers, and they remain to be part of the workforce even now that the industry has moved on to modern technology, with much of the work being done on machines. In fact, a quarter of the 1,400 strong workforce that produced the Brazuca at Forward Sports Factory were women.
Now, it's one specific factory in Sialkot that's making the official Brazuca balls that will be used in the World Cup matches, but other factories in the city have also received massive orders to produce soccer balls. So this year's World Cup is turning out to be a pretty significant economic boom for the region.
Yes, the Sialkot Dry Port authorities have reported that until now, 42 million soccer balls worth 18 million rupees have been exported ahead of the 2014 FIFA World Cup. Many of the factories there are still receiving large orders as soccer fever rises alongside the biggest sporting event in the world. You have to note here that Sialkot is the only city in Pakistan which exports 99% of the products developed here. And with the attention Brazuca has brought to the city's sporting good industry, who knows what the possibilities could bring in this year.
Pakistani journalist Midhut Alizaidi speaking there to FSN's Mary McCarthy. And so it seems sensible to put Brazil under the FSN spotlight tonight. For the past few days, the country has seen riots in Sao Paulo amid ongoing disputes over whether the World Cup will deliver any kind of economic benefit to the majority of Brazil's population. The country is also poised to host the Olympics in 2016, and there are lots of discussions underway about the extent to which Brazil's development is creating a genuine middle class or enriching a narrow sliver at the top. Michael Reed writes the Bellow column for The Economist. He's the newspaper's writer-at-large for the Americas, and his new book is called Brazil, The Troubled Rise of a Global Power. He spoke to Fiametta Rocco, The Economist's literary editor.
I think the remarkable thing about Brazil is that people now know that it's an important country. I mean, it's the world's fourth most populous democracy. It's the world's seventh biggest economy. It has ambitions to be a global power. I wanted to write this book because there's growing interest in Brazil. I felt that there were unsaid things to say about Brazil, and I've tried to say them in this book.
The subtitle of your book is The Troubled Rise of a Global Power. What does Brazil need to do to really become a global power?
I think Brazil, yes, it sees itself as a southern power, but it's also in many ways a western power. So it needs to work out who its allies, best allies, really are. And they may not be China and Russia, for example. I think it also needs to work out exactly what kind of role it wants to play in South America. It kind of wants to be the leader in Latin America, but doesn't want to at the same time, because it's a reluctant leader. It's been very reluctant to open up its economy to its neighbors. The economy is still too protected. It's isolated itself because of that protectionism from global value chains. So I think if Brazil is to realize the potential it clearly has to be a really significant country in the world, it needs to get economic growth back up again, and that requires economic reforms, but it also needs to make some changes to its foreign policy, and I argue that in the book.
We've heard a lot in the last few weeks about problems relating to the run-up to the World Cup. Social problems, economic problems, problems broadly related to a failure to deliver somehow. Is that an accurate view?
It's an accurate view, but it's only half the story. And I discuss those problems in the book. And they're to do with, I think, the way that, centrally, with the way that the state has evolved in Brazil. I mean, Brazil collects 38% of GDP in taxes, which is a similar figure to the OECD countries, the rich countries. And yet Brazilians get, in too many cases, third world services for that, because the money goes on the wrong things. But on the other hand, there's a really fascinating success story in Brazil over the last 20 years. Democratic governments took over when the country was racked by hyperinflation, by economic stagnation, and great social injustice. They stabilized the economy, tamed inflation, that was under Cardoso. Lula, with much more ambitious social policies, has made big inroads in reducing inequalities. Some 30 to 40 million people have left poverty behind. And Brazil is in many ways a vibrant and successful democracy.
There's a very widespread view in Brazil, probably to do with its history, that the state really is the solution to most of its problems. How much is that a problem in itself?
The average Brazilian thinks that the state should solve his or her problems. But a very dysfunctional state has grown up in Brazil. It was very successful for a while in pushing economic growth. I mean, between 1930 and 1982, Brazil was probably the fastest growing economy in the world. But the state is too big and spends lots of money on the wrong things. I mean, Brazil spends as big a share of national income on pensions, even though it's a young country demographically, as the geriatric societies of Southern Europe, and that is unsustainable. Too much money goes to the insiders. There are too many veto players in the system. There are no fewer than 21 political parties represented in the Congress, and nearly all of them want a slice of the action. So the next challenge for Brazil is to take that state and make it work to provide better public services that the protesters in the streets last year were demanding.
On many levels, it's a very, very dynamic, vibrant, innovative country. What can the rest of the world learn from Brazil?
I think the fundamental lesson is that, you know, democracy can work to overcome poverty and inequality. And as I say, there's, you know, a long way to go, but the progress has been inspiring in many ways. There's also a lesson of tolerance in Brazil. Brazil is genuinely a rainbow nation. That's not to say that racism doesn't exist, and there's a big debate about that at the moment. But Brazil does not suffer the kind of, you know, binary racial divide that came that you have in still have in the United States or South Africa, say. But I do think that, you know, one shouldn't romanticize this. I mean, Brazil tends to evolve through gradual change without rupture, for better or for worse, and it's sometimes for worse. And there is an undercurrent of violence in the society, which I think also comes from the legacy of slavery. But I think in many ways it is a country that is an example of tolerance to the rest of the world.
That's Michael Reed of The Economist. His new book is called Brazil, The Troubled Rise of a Global Power. It's published by Yale University Press. And that's our edition of FSN Reports for today. Let us know what you think of the programme. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter. We are there @featurestory. I'm Simon Marks in Washington for everyone with FSN everywhere. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.